5:05 was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The U.S. prepares to step up the fight against the Islamic State. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, in remarks to U.S. lawmakers Wednesday, said the United States is prepared to do more in taking the fight to the Islamic State in both Iraq and Syria, saying Washington is prepared to increase its assistance as Iraq tries to retake the provincial capital, Ramadi.
Over the past several months, the coalition has provided specialized training and equipment, including combat engineering techniques like in-stride breaching and bulldozing, and munitions like AT-4 shoulder-fired missiles to stop truck bombs, up to the Iraqi Army and its counterterrorism service units that are now beginning to enter Ramadi neighborhoods from multiple directions.
But he deflected demands for a greater U.S. ground presence.
By seeming to Americanize the conflicts in Iraq and Syria, we could well turn those fighting ISIL or inclined to resist their rule into fighting us instead. As Chairman Dunford testified last week, quote, ISIL would love nothing more than a large presence of U.S. forces on the ground in Iraq and Syria so that they could have a call to jihad.
In Baghdad Wednesday, Britt McGurk, the U.S. official in charge of the coalition against the IS, said hundreds of civilians are trapped in central Ramadi, subjected to booby-trapped buildings and the ongoing fighting. He says IS fighters are taking human shields as hostages. U.S. airstrikes in support of the Iraqi forces continued Wednesday, hitting large IS tactical units, vehicles, command and control centers, and bomb factories. Torrential rains and flooding left more than 30 dead and forced tens of thousands from their homes in the capital of Democratic Republic of Congo over the past 3 weeks. The flooding has overwhelmed the main water collection station, preventing more residents of Kinshasa access to drinkable water. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry Wednesday said he plans to travel to Moscow next week for talks with Russian leaders on Ukraine and the political settlement in Syria. Mr. Kerry said despite Russia's military and political interests in Damascus, Moscow has been constructive in trying to find a political settlement to end the Syrian conflict. John Kirby is a U.S. spokesman.
They have been able to help bring other parties to the table in Vienna. And I'm not going to get into every diplomatic discussion and every bit of nuance in the communiques that have been filed after the Vienna meetings, but I can assure you that the Russians have been integral to getting to those texts and to helping what is now 18 countries plus the Arab League and the EU together in the room and helping everybody unify around some core principles, such as ISIL's got to go, such as it has to be a Syrian-led political transition process in Syria.
Mr. Kerry's trip to Moscow expected to precede a possible international meeting in New York December 18 on efforts to push the Syrian political process forward. A Taliban assault on a key airport in southern Afghanistan killed 37 and wounded 35 others as clashes continued into Wednesday. Meanwhile, Taliban militants overran a district in neighboring Helmand province, leaving 14 policemen dead and several others wounded. President Obama reaffirmed what he called the unbreakable bond between the U.S. and Israel during a White House meeting Wednesday with visiting Israeli President Reuven Rivlin. He said the U.S. wants to be helpful in reducing tensions with Palestinians. Recent unrest between the two have left dozens dead since early October.
I've been very clear in condemning the violence that is recurring inside of Israel. The need for leaders like President Abbas to unequivocally condemn the violence that's been taking place, the need to end incitement, but also the need for Israelis and Palestinians to find mechanisms in which to dialogue and arrive at peace.
The two countries are currently negotiating a 10-year security agreement. Dissident Russian tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky said Wednesday a revolution in the country is inevitable. Addressing a conference in London, Khodorkovsky, former head of Russia's Yukos oil company, accused President Vladimir Putin of having presided over a full-fledged unconstitutional coup. South African President Jacob Zuma has fired his finance minister, Nlenle Nene, in the wake of a credit rating downgrade to just one position above sub-investment grade by Fitch. The South African economy is barely growing, squeezed by low commodity prices. The two have disagreed over the financing of a nuclear power plant in an effort to ease a power shortage. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 10th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundi promises swifter positive actions in addressing the crisis that has beleaguered the country since April this year.
We are hopeful that the dialogue that we have had, plus the work that we are going to undertake from now, are going to yield positive results, which would not warrant any other negative measures.
Ali Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe is alarmed by the level of divisions within his ruling ZANU-PF party. And South African President Jacob Zuma fires his finance minister.
Because finance minister Nene was seen as a steady hand when it came to financial management, the removal of the finance minister has caused shockwaves, and the currency has been depreciating rapidly.
Daryl Glaser is the head of the political science department at South Africa's Witwatersrand University. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry urges negotiators at the climate change conference to reach a strong agreement. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump's comment about Muslims has provoked a global outrage. And Kobe Bryant bids farewell to NBA basketball. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundi's foreign minister says his government is on the right track and will deliver in coming few weeks in addressing the crisis which has beleaguered the country since April this year when President Pierre Nkurunziza decided to seek a third term. Ali Nyamitwe said hereafter his government will expedite investigations into the role of independent media houses which were shut down by what he calls judicial measures because of their alleged roles in last May's alleged failed coup. He also said the government will speed up investigations of those who have been jailed for their involvement in anti-government demonstrations. Nyamitwe's comments follow consultation this week with the European Union. He says while Bujumbura did not get the expected results from the meeting, it, however, appreciates the frank discussions.
Although we did not get the expected results in those consultations, we have very much appreciated the frank discussions that we had with our EU counterparts. We continue to believe that it was a right step forward because for more than 7 months, we had not had any close dialogue with our EU counterparts. So I think it is a positive step.
What were you expecting when you went into the consultations?
Our expectation, number one, was for the EU to pronounce itself clearly that they were resuming traditional cooperation with us. Notwithstanding, they said that they have not frozen the cooperation, but they were considering additional measures in case our dialogue did not yield results. And we are hopeful that the dialogue that we have had, plus the work that we are going to undertake from now, are going to yield positive results, which would not warrant any other negative measures.
Is it true that the EU told your government that it wasn't pleased with your respect to the Cotonou Agreement?
No, actually, they didn't say that they weren't pleased, but they weren't satisfied. I mean, they were expecting more from us. What they got was possibly not at the height of their expectation.
Mr. Minister, what did you promise the EU your government is going to do when you go back to Bujumbura?
Actually, there were 9 thematic issues that we discussed. Number one, I believe, was in respect to the radio stations which were shut down or suspended by judicial measures. We have accepted that, you know, the investigation which have started into the allegations concerning the implications or involvement of some registrations or journalists into the coup or other illegal activities, that those investigations would be conducted swiftly and produce results. Now, once those investigations will be positive, we clarify and clear some of those journalists or radio stations, then those which are concerned will be concerned by that investigation will be also cleared to air once again. The same applies to the NGOs which were suspended by the justice decision. They will also have to be investigated. And then, you know, in a short period of time, once we clarify the outcome of the investigation, then they will also be cleared. So in a nutshell, we believe that we are set on the right track and we are going to deliver. Definitely in the few weeks to come.
The last time we talked, you said that the government had everything under control. And I asked you a question about the violence. Even on Wednesday, as we speak, there was a report that five people were shot by the police because they threw grenades at the patrol. What can you tell our listeners about violence in Burundi?
Well, let me first of all say that, you know, it is unfortunate that people have died in that incident. But maybe let me ask the question, what would be the response of any police force, wherever in the world, when they are attacked by armed people who are using hand grenades, sometimes even rocket-propelled grenades, sometimes even AK-47s? How do you respond to such fire? Is it by saying, oh, we are sorry, go ahead and kill us, or it's by reply, you know, using fire, you know, because fire begets fire? I mean, take the example of the U.S. What would the police do if a person armed with hand grenade would use it against the police force? Tell me.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the Belgian capital, Brussels. South African President Jacob Zuma Wednesday fired his finance minister, Nhlanhla Nene, promising to reassign him to another strategic position. But Darryl Glaser, head of the political science department at Witwatersrand University, says Nene was dumped because he opposed some of President Zuma's pet projects. He also said that because finance minister Nene was seen as a steady hand when it came to financial management, his removal has caused shockwaves, and South African currency has been depreciating rapidly.
Basically, there's a widespread perception now that this is part of a process by which the president is increasing his grip on the state and trying to gain control of the finances. And because Finance Minister Nene was seen as a steady hand when it came to financial management, the removal of the finance minister has caused shockwaves, and the currency has been depreciating rapidly.
There's a report that is hinting that perhaps Mr. Nene was removed because, as the finance minister, he had been dragging his feet in providing money for a nuclear power deal. Could it be that's one of the reasons?
It could certainly be one of the reasons. It's one of the major discussion points and sources of anxiety in South Africa that Zuma and some other senior people in the cabinet have committed South Africa, we don't know how binding the commitment is yet, to spending billions of South African rands, possibly a trillion South African rands, on buying nuclear power plants from Russia to help meet South Africa's urgent energy needs. Most people consider this to be a very dangerous, open-ended financial commitment for a country that already has a significant budget deficit and budget strains. I think Nene, the perception is that he was standing in the way of that indeed, and that Zuma considers him a problem for that reason.
The president, Mr. Zuma, has been quoted as saying that Mr. Nene has done well since his appointment as Minister of Finance during a difficult economic period. If that is the case, so people are scratching their heads, why do you remove him if you think he's done well?
I mean, Nene, to be sure, sometimes comes across as very bureaucratic and technocratic and a bit as lacking the popular touch. But he's nevertheless seen as someone who keeps a careful and competent eye on finances. It's precisely for this reason that the suspicion turns to some kind of political motive.
President Zuma said he's going to replace Nene with David Van Ruyen. He's an ANC member of parliament. What do you know about Mr. Ruyen?
Very little is known about him, apart from the fact that he's politically relatively junior, which means that he might not have the kind of clout that a finance minister needs. He is certainly very well qualified. He's got all sorts of local and international degrees in business management and so on. And he's also had experience in local government management. So there's no shortage of experience there. But the suspicion is going to be that he's being put in this position for a reason, and that's because he's going to be more compliant with what President Zuma wants.
Darryl Glaser is head of the Political Science Department at South Africa's Witwatersrand University. You're speaking with me from Johannesburg. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 10th. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe has expressed alarm at the level of divisions in his ruling ZANU-PF party, calling for a moratorium on the issuing of votes of no confidence in a party that have led to the suspension and expulsion of party members. Mr. Mugabe addressed the media Wednesday shortly before chairing the party's central committee meeting. The majority of those targeted are linked to a faction of ZANU-PF led by Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa. Pezisaye Ruhanya is director of the Zimbabwe Democracy Institute. He says he's not amused by Mnangagwa's silence.
I think if you look at the history of Mnangagwa, is that in all the power struggles in ZANU that has taken place this far, Mnangagwa is usually guided by what President Robert Mugabe says. So his quietness is a strategy to read what the president wants. And once the president says something, Mnangagwa has always been an obedient son of the president. Even if the president says you are fired, Emmerson, Emmerson will go. He understands ZANU politics and he knows that it is Mugabe who has the last word on anything that happens in ZANU. That's why he is quiet. It's not lack of strategy. He wants to understand the direction of the president. And once the president gives the direction, even if it means that he is going to be hanged, Mnangagwa will go to hang.
And let's look at this new demand, allegedly, by women in some provinces that they want a woman to be in the presidium. What is your take on this development?
I don't think that there's anything wrong. Groups in ZANU have the right to make demand on how they want to be structured, how they want their party to be organized, and how they want particularly women to be represented. But the idea of the presidium, in my understanding, is four people. We have vice president, two vice president, the president, national chairperson, and I think secretary for administration. So it means that a lady can be any of those posts.
And lastly, Dr. Ruhanya, Mr. Mugabe has not said much this far. Do you think he is endorsing these suspensions and expulsions of party members?
No, the president usually takes time to read. And while the president takes time, he will be getting intelligence on what the implications are in his party.
Pezisaye Ruhanya is director of the Zimbabwe Democracy Institute. He was speaking with Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe program. With time running out at the climate talks near Paris, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has urged nations to put aside their differences and reach a strong deal that puts the planet on a more sustainable trajectory. He also announced the U.S. will double grants to $860 million for poor nations to adapt to climate change. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
With just hours left to go to reach a climate deal, Secretary of State Kerry summed up his message in just a few words.
Our task is clear. Our moment is now. Let's get this job done.
Negotiators now have less than 2 days to reach an agreement aimed to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius or less over pre-industrial levels. French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius, who is presiding over the talks outside Paris, says a new draft introduced Wednesday is whittled down. It's now 29 pages instead of 43, and agreement appears close in areas like climate change adaptation and technology transfer to poorer countries.
Et j'ai noté que trois questions transversales devront faire l'objet.
But Fabius said three key sticking points remain: differentiation or distinctions between rich and poor nations in fighting climate change, climate financing, and how ambitious the Paris Agreement should be. Kerry said any deal reached in Paris should be considered a start and not an end in cutting carbon emissions. He directed part of his message to developing countries as he urged greater compromise in reaching a deal.
If all the industrial nations went down to zero emissions, remember what I just said, all the industrial nations went down to zero emissions, it wouldn't be enough. Not when more than 65% of the world's carbon pollution comes from the developing world.
He also appeared to direct his message closer to home, where some Americans question whether climate change exists or man's role in causing it. Even if the vast majority of science proves wrong and climate skeptics are right, he said, the world is still better off with a climate deal.
But on the other side of the ledger, If the scientists are right and the climate skeptics are wrong, we face catastrophe. It's that simple. That is the choice.
Delegates face a Thursday deadline to produce a climate plan that can be formally adopted on Friday. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Comments by U.S. presidential candidate Donald Trump that all Muslims should be banned temporarily from entering the United States have triggered an angry reaction across the world. Trump said that a ban should be put in place until authorities can figure out Muslim attitudes towards the United States in the wake of deadly shootings in California. Henry Richwell reports from London.
More than 100,000 Britons have signed an online petition calling for Donald Trump to be banned from entering the country, meaning the proposal will be considered for debate in Parliament. Scottish National Party lawmaker Tasmina Ahmed Sheikh said the same rules should be applied to Trump as those used against extremist Muslim preachers.
We've already banned 84 hate preachers from this country. My view is that what Donald Trump said amounts to hate speak, and therefore my question to the government is, let's consider making him number 85.
In Paris, the psychological wounds left by November's Islamic State terror attacks are still raw, but many Parisians condemned Trump's comments, like student Matilda Adrovich. She said Donald Trump should not have a place in American politics. Indonesia has the world's largest Muslim population. Residents of Jakarta, like Anis Ekayani, were eager to refute Trump's claim that Muslims pose a threat.
Islam sendiri mengajarkan bahwa untuk saling ber.
She said Islam teaches us to always do good things to fellow human beings, so the comment by Trump is very inappropriate because it reflects an attitude that is against Islam. Trump has suggested that the United States should have seized Iraq's oil fields and given the money to veteran soldiers. His latest comments on banning Muslims were met with anger by Iraqi lawmaker Abbas al-Bayati. Al-Bayati said the statements are racist and are not in line with principles of American democracy. The UN Refugee Agency said the United States offers the largest refugee resettlement program in the world and said it is concerned the election campaign rhetoric is putting that system at risk. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
National Basketball Association superstar Kobe Bryant recently announced that this will be his final season with the Los Angeles Lakers, a team he has led to five championships. The announcement is giving fans across the league an opportunity to say goodbye when he and the Lakers come to their cities. The two-time Olympic gold medalist and 17-time NBA All-Star made his final appearance here in Washington, D.C. earlier this month, and viewers Park Brewer was there.
Playing in the nation's capital on this night in his 20th and final NBA season, 37-year-old Kobe Bryant showed many of the skills that have made him one of the NBA's all-time best players. Whether he plays at home or on the road, he has legions of followers. Here in Washington, that was no different.
I've been a Lakers fan since day one. Since the first championship, I've been a Lakers fan ever since, man. Kobe fan for life.
Joshua Bailey said it was the best gift ever when girlfriend Adrian Good got them tickets for this game.
Just a great end to a great career. You know, I think it is time for him, you know, to end. But, you know, I mean, you can't say enough about his legacy and what he meant to L.A. and just for the fans, you know.
We can't expect him to continue to go on and on. So it's just an honor to see him play for this last time, and it's just a great experience. But I'm glad he's retiring. Everybody gets a time.
Very few professional sports stars stay with one team for their entire careers, especially when others offer them more money.
Loyalty, you don't see that in players. You don't see that in football, basketball. You don't see none that kind of loyalty in any of those sports. But it's been a blessing having Kobe on the Laker team for 20 years.
And seeing him make amazing long-distance shots like he did throughout the game against Washington. He said afterward it was because he felt excellent physically.
When I have my legs, you know, I can go through that shot, and I feel very comfortable in that shot and stopping and pulling up. So, you know, once I knew I had my legs, I felt pretty comfortable going to it.
Kobe Bryant is expected to play before sellout crowds as he plays his final road games around the league. Afterward, he said he surprised himself how well he played, leading the Lakers with 31 points, double his season average, and scoring what proved to be the game-winning shot in a 108-104 victory over Washington.
I was thinking about that in the locker room. I was thinking, you know, what did I do differently? It was just something, and I still don't know.
His coach, Byron Scott, also was pleasantly surprised.
I don't know, you know, how many more performances he'll have like this, but I expect him to play, you know, with that type of passion that he plays with every single night. You know, I don't know if it'll be these type of outcomes, but the one thing I do know is he'll give it everything he's got.
And that's all fans can ask for from Kobe Bryant as he says farewell during his final season. Park Brewer, VOA News, Washington.
Here's Mark Olma in Johannesburg, South Africa, with the rest of Daybreak Africa Sports. Good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Captain Otebo Ogenekaro scored a penalty in the 78th minute to inspire Nigeria to a 1-0 triumph over hosts Senegal in the semifinals at the Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations in Dakar on Wednesday. Later on, Osama Dal Falou and Mohamed Benkemasa found the back of the net in each half to lift Algeria to a 2-0 victory over South Africa. In Qatar, FIFA will only finalize how many stadiums will be used at the 2022 FIFA World Cup in Qatar next month. The Assistant General Secretary of the 2022 Local Organizing Committee, Nasser Al-Khattab, told the media in Doha at the end of a FIFA inspection tour. Qatar has planned to build 12 stadiums for the event. However, FIFA appear keen on settling in for a fewer number of venues. Al-Khattab says they hope to have all stadiums construction completed by 2020. In Japan, FIFA have signed their first ever sponsorship deal with a Chinese company. The FIFA marketing director Thierry Weil revealed in Tokyo, Japan on Wednesday. FIFA and Alibaba eAuto concluded an 8-year presentation partnership for the annual FIFA Club World Cup. Alibaba eAuto will present the most valuable player award at each match. The Alibaba Sports chief executive Zhang Dazhu says this is part of the Alibaba Group's theme of health and happiness. They aim to add value for participants and consumers in the sports sector through data-driven internet technology. Turning to handball, Angola lost 29-27 to Poland at the World Women's Handball Championship in Nysdvet, Denmark on Wednesday. Earlier on Tuesday, the Angolans beat Cuba 38-24 to hand Africa their only victory at the global event so far. Tomorrow Friday, Angola play China in a must-win encounter to keep hope alive of advancing to the knockout stage. Meanwhile, Tunisia plays Serbia and the Democratic Republic of Congo challenge Germany in their last group matches. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Tanzanians marked their country's Independence Day Wednesday, not with a parade, but by cleaning the streets. The president included. President John Magufuli was one of several top officials who picked up trash around the capital, Dar es Salaam, as part of a nationwide cleanup exercise. The newly elected president, who campaigned on promises to reduce corruption and waste, said last month he was canceling the traditional Independence Day festivities. That is it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good Thursday.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hi, I'm Susan Yawkey of VOA's International Edition. VOA's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of some of the world's greatest experts on international issues. But you don't have to tune in at broadcast time. Listen when you want. Just go to voanews.com. Click the Programs tab and scroll down to International Edition.